Yep, and continue on here. We are get before you the doctrine of suffering. As per the types of suffering, one of the things we see here is undeserved suffering that John the Baptist was going through. And so eventually, of course, we'll review this doctrine, and then suffering will crank up in your life, and you'll blame me, but that's fine. We have to cover this from time to time, though, just to keep it before us. Preliminary considerations here. A suffering is defined as undergoing or bearing something that causes pain, grief, distress, or injury. Suffering is painful by its very nature. 1 Peter 1:6. We're going to deal with the types of suffering, and there are various kinds. The suffering that you bring on yourself, we call that self-induced misery. And then there is undeserved suffering, suffering that you don't do anything to cause. For instance, like John the Baptist, he takes a stand for righteousness in this matter, and he gets jammed up by Herod. 1 Peter 1:6, in this, and he's talking about in context here that we are protected by the power of God. This is one of the things that the positive believer knows, or should know, part of the repertoire, is that as a positive believer, as you live the Christian life and seek to grow in grace and all these other factors, that as long as you're growing and moving on, until God has some overriding consideration, I mean, you are essentially immortal at that level. God protects you. He watches out for you. He'll even protect you from your own stupidity and that sort of thing. I mean, there's been times when, you know, I've looked the wrong way or something, and or missed something. I mean, you've probably had it happen. You'll be driving along or something, and somehow you just miss, completely miss a vehicle that's coming at you or in front of you or whatever, and you just barely escape some serious wreck. Well, God's obviously protecting you. God, we know that there are guardian angels. I've never seen one. I doubt that any of you have, but if you have, then you certainly know they exist. But here we know that we're protected through faith for a deliverance. Verse 5, that deliverance in context is the rapture that's ready to be revealed in the last time. This is the greatest deliverance of all the deliverances that God ever provides, to my thinking. Now, obviously, it was a pretty good deliverance if you got on the ark. That was a pretty good deliverance. Other than that, how long can you tread water? And you can't tread water for a year. And that's about the extent of the time that the flood went on. I mean, obviously, the flood, the whole earth didn't flood sort of immediately. It took some time for the fountains of the deep to give up their waters and for the vapor canopy to precipitate out. But we do know that the flood as an event was like a year-long procedure. So, you know, if you were on the ark, that was good. Not on the ark, not so good. That's a great deliverance. We see the deliverance of the Jews as they come out of Egypt from slavery. Obviously, the phase one deliverance of the believer at salvation is a great deliverance. But at the rapture, all believers of the church age, living and dead, are taken off the planet simultaneously. And I say simultaneously, there's actually an order of events in there. The dead in Christ are raised first, and then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them to meet the Lord in the air. And so God delivers the entire church from Daniel's 70th week, from that hour which is about to try the whole earth. The final 7 years of the prophecy of Daniel's 70 weeks, the 490 years that was pronounced upon the Jews back in Daniel chapter 9. So that is a great deliverance that we are waiting for. And in this you greatly rejoice. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty excited about the idea of the rapture. I'd like to get out of here. I would prefer to be in my resurrection body. I would like to have whatever eternal rewards I'm going to have, and then the capacity to live and enjoy them and all those things. And so that would be great. But even though now, for a little while, if necessary, first class condition, and it is, it's presumed as necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. Trials, by their very nature, are distressing. They upset you. They make you anxious or fearful or whatever they make you, cause you grief. But they are, by their very nature, stressful. And you're not going to eliminate stress in your life as a believer. There's just no way to do that. There's no way for people in the world, anybody, to eliminate all stress from their life. And so it's a matter of how you deal with stress, how you handle it. And it has to be fielded with doctrine. Doctrine's the only thing that's really, if God created the human being, first class condition, and he did, then he understands exactly how humans work. He's the only one who truly does. Humans can try to understand how humans work, and they may get some insights. But as far as knowing what God knows, nobody knows that. So if you're going to deal with life as it comes, if you don't deal with it with doctrine, you're going to deal with it with something far less. And something far less won't work long term. That's the big issue in life, is that you have to be willing to address things from the divine viewpoint and be rigorous about it. You can't just do it when you feel like it or when it's convenient. You got to do it all the time. And usually the harder the suffering, that's the more time you really need to buckle down and bear down. Because the more difficult the test, you really do want to pass it. And under suffering and various tests, there is a principle that if you do not pass the test, God is free to give you the same test over and over again until you pass it. So the best thing to do, of course, is try to orient. Now, none of us do it perfectly, I know that. But to try to orient out of the chute and pass the test the first time. Otherwise, you keep having it. And so then you keep having to fight the same fight, as it were, over and over again. And we've all done it. So, I mean, none of us are immune to it or above it. But in an ideal world, this is what we want to do. So B, although the Greek verb lupeo is primarily limited to mental and emotional distress, it is evident that a believer may suffer mentally, physically, or both. 2 Corinthians 11, and this is a passage in which Paul delineates the types of sufferings that he faced. Well, I don't think you're going to read this list and think, oh, well, that's not difficult, or that's easy, or that's not suffering. You're going to realize that all these things are sufferings indeed. And here's what Paul's doing. He has to, part of the deal here, you have to understand this is sanctified boasting on Paul's part. He has to engage in this in order to refute his critics and to try to win back at some level the loyalty of the Corinthians who had been alienated from Paul by these false teachers, false apostles, probably even based on people within the Corinthian church as well. But the reality is he has to point out to them, look, here's the kind of ministry I've conducted. What kind of ministry are these people conducting? And he basically tells the Corinthians, I never took a penny from you people. So, but are your false apostles acting in the same way, or are they taking your money? And it wasn't as though Paul didn't know that he could take money from the Corinthians. He knew the doctrine and the principles because he spells it out to them. He said, just because I'm doing it, I don't think this is the way it should be in every case. But I have my reasons, my doctrinal reasons, for why I won't take money from you. And he took money from other churches like the Philippians that we know. The end of the Philippians there is all about that monetary gift they sent Paul. So here's Paul's ministry. Are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. Why am I even having to say this, he's saying to himself. Paul doesn't like bragging about himself. No, most normal people really don't. If you got any doctrine, you've long ago learned, let another man's lips praise you and not your own. But there comes a time and a place in the life of a communicator when it's time to put your foot down, stand up, and say, this is the ministry, take it or leave it, get it with it or get out. And to draw a line in the sand and spell out, look, here's the kind of ministry I've conducted. It's never been about money. It's never been about authority. It's never been about these other factors. It's been about trying to get you the soundest level of doctrine that you can get. And that's what Paul argues here, that I've done all this, and I've done it right. And he had, of course. But he says, why am I even saying this? This sounds crazy. This is crazy talk, essentially. I'm more so than a servant of Christ than them, in far more labors, far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. 1 and a day I have spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches. And so Paul suffers at some level, as all communicators suffer. I mean, you really want to see people make it. You want them to really get with God's plan and exploit the principles of grace maximize their time in here, and blessings in time and blessings in eternity. As John prays for those under his charge, the constant prayer I have, that you'll prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. But soul prosperity is the foremost thing. That's what's got to come first. And that, we believe, comes through the intake and application of doctrine, feeding your soul the sound principles of the truth that you need in order to navigate this devil's world. And the devil's world is a horrible place. The Bible never makes any allusions that it's any different. It points out that it is a dark place, that light is necessary in order to function within it. The devil's world is based on principles of pride, fear, lust, greed, can all you can, get all you can, screw everybody else, and that's it. The strong survive, winner takes all kind of mentality. God's plan is not like that. And you notice nothing in the devil's world is free. I don't see that there's ever any, you know, money mentioned in heaven. Why? Because I think everything's going to be free. You can take of the fruit of the tree of life freely. You can drink of the water of life freely. God doesn't charge for stuff. That really sets him apart from the devil in that sense. So the Greek verb lupeo here, again, is primarily limited. I mean, that's the way it's used most of the time, to mental and emotional distress. But clearly, Paul suffers both here, mentally and physically, in big ways. See, a believer may endure suffering willingly or be forced into it. However, suffering out of fellowship does not glorify God or accrue reward for the believer. D, this doctrine will focus on the believer, the types of suffering he may experience, and the divine viewpoint about how he should address the issue of suffering. E, the believer faces some of the same sufferings or tests that are common to all members of the human race. 1 Corinthians 10:13. And we call these CHPs, common human problems. Everybody faces them. You get old, one of the common human problems you face is aging, which isn't too bad when you're in your 20s. A little worse when you're in the 30s. 40s a little rougher. 50s, God help you. 60s, you might as well just start buying a coffin. And 70s, well, you know, that's all you're promised, really. If you get to the 70s, you've done well. Because really, we're only promised the 70 and 10 in the Psalms there. Moses wrote that Psalm, Psalm 90, and it says you get 70 years generally. But if by virtue of strength you get 80, okay, that's fine. Some people get more than that. We recognize that. But one of the sufferings that we all face is just aging. So, you know, as I remember one of my favorite lines out of that was out of the movie Peggy Sue Got Married. Well, if you had it to do all over again, Grandpa, what would you do? I'd have taken better care of my teeth. So you can have a toothache, you have, you know, tooth decay, you have problems, your eyesight can go. Normally about 40 you'll start thinking, my arms need to be longer. That's when nearsight or farsightedness usually sets in, is around 40. And for years I was fortunate I didn't have that, but about 45 it finally hit me. So now I have to get progressives, the more expensive glasses, rather than just, you know, single vision. Well, that happens. Your sight goes, your hearing goes, your teeth go, colon, you know. All the internal organs are decaying as you get older. They're aging and all that. So you have to, as somebody said, the key to life is a healthy colon. I don't know if it's true or not, but we all face these kinds of tests. And so we have to deal with it. 1 Corinthians 10:13, no temptation has taken you but such as is common to man. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. Now, have you ever been in the middle of a test and thought, oh yeah, this verse isn't true? You've thought that, right? I mean, you get in the middle of it and you're thinking, I'm being pushed beyond my ability to handle it. Well, no, you're not. You just think you are. And of course, God knows what we need, and so he's constantly pushing the buttons to get us to maximize. You can be a better person. Yeah, but it's painful to grow sometimes. Yeah, it is. Growth can be painful because you have to come to admit your weaknesses, your shortcomings, your failures, and strive for better success. So God is faithful, and he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but will with the temptation provide the way of escape, so that you may be able to endure it. So we can endure temptation. We can endure suffering. And temptation is it's a more specific part of suffering, but it is part of suffering. There's the broad umbrella of suffering. Well, temptation is part of that. When you're tempted to do wrong. Sometimes you just, let's face it, I know the fundies are going to vibrate, but let's face it, sometimes we don't want to not say no. We want to sin. And if sin, again, this is the whole deal. I never understood this, even when I was a fundy. If sin wasn't fun, nobody would be doing it. I mean, good grief. People don't do that which is just odious and offensive to them all the time. I mean, not to say that they don't sometimes, but generally speaking, people take the path of least resistance and that which makes them happy. That's the normal kind of human deal. I want to be happy. Don't you want to be happy? I mean, normal people want to be happy. The question becomes, of course, how do we go about attaining happiness? And then the ever-elusive happiness, as Alanis Morissette put it, those transparent dangling carrots that we're constantly chasing. And then if we catch them, what do you have? A transparent carrot. That's all you have. And happiness, how fleeting is it when you get it? You know, like your team wins a Super Bowl, go out, turn cars over, whatever they do, set fires in the street, you know, rob stores and all that. But how long does that last? Well, that euphoria doesn't last long, unfortunately. And so you pursue happiness and then you get it and then you think, okay, it's gone. Now I've got to find another way to be happy. So how am I going to make myself happy now? Well, some people think happiness is to be achieved by a lack of suffering. Not true. That's just a fallacious view. Because you're going to have suffering and testing and these types of things. And the question is, can you be happy in your circumstances? Can you be happy in spite of your circumstances? And that's the big deal there. That's the big test, is to learn how to be happy, to learn to be content in whatever place you find yourself. And so you have sort of this constant conflict between wanting to be contented and then the fact that you're not always contented. Well, true happiness, we believe, is built out. True happiness, number one, comes from the capacity to have it. And most people don't have any capacity for life. They think life is whatever they think it is, and when it comes at them, they don't really enjoy it. And life can be a drudgery. And Solomon went through that in excruciating detail in Ecclesiastes. The drudgery of life and what it can be. A day comes, a day goes. The sea goes in, the sea goes out. The water ascends, it rains back on the earth, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, it is just dull, boring, tedium at some points. Now, can you be happy in dull, boring, tedium? Well, if you have capacity for life, you can. And so we talk about capacity, and David talks about it in Psalm 23 when he says, my cup runs over. Well, his cup represents his capacity for life, and the running over is the blessings of life that he has capacity for. And he says, God provides more than I can even hold. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And if you live in America, the prayer is, I am constantly in want, and I need this. And then fill in the blank, whatever is the new big deal everybody needs. And so everybody got, you know, the people, and I don't have anything now personally against technology, so understand this. Technology in and of itself is neutral. But the pursuit of this doesn't make people happy. Having the newest, latest gadgets of every kind. And does this make people happy? No. We took a trip last year. We went up and met with the Reeds and had some time of R&R. And, you know, I borrowed Bill's GPS because I was too lazy to go buy my own. And so I have this technology, and I'm thinking, okay, fine, I can't get lost. Well, the thing gets me lost. It's given me a bad signal, and so thank God I could still read a map from my Boy Scout days. Because the technology didn't help me. It kept telling me to go south when I should have been going north. And I'm looking around. Of course, I'm completely in a new area. I've never been there before. I mean, you're driving through the foothills of Tennessee, and you're thinking, well, I don't recognize, you know. Once you get off of 75, it gets a little hairy back in there. So, but I'm thinking, oh, the technology, I can't get lost. Yeah, you can. You can get turned around even with technology. And it can, you know, and of course, the woman in heaven there, you know, I called her the bitch in the box because she constantly was saying stuff to me. And it was like, turn, turn, turn. And I'm like, no. I knew it wasn't right to turn. So that, you know, technology has its place, you know, and I guess it's good. But the reliance on tech, is technology going to solve people's problems? No, no. So we have this deal here of sufferings that we all face. You live in a devil's world, you're going to face certain sufferings. F1 difference is that the positive adjusting believer has the knowledge that God is working on his behalf. See, that's an important thing to know going in. All his sufferings are being caused to work together for his ultimate good. Romans 8:28, a verse that you're probably familiar with. But here's the thing you have to keep, and this is where the knowledge of doctrine is indispensable. When Paul makes these assertions, and many of Paul's thoughts begin with these words, we know. How do we know? Well, Paul knows from Revelation, and if we believe Paul's communication, then we can know too. So we know that God causes all things to work together for good. Now, that doesn't say that all things are good. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say anything other than that God is behind the scenes orchestrating the events of your life in ways that you don't understand. That he's bigger than all this. And you think, and because one of the things I go through kind of as a believer, you think, well, I'm just this guy, one guy here living in Sarasota or wherever you live. It doesn't make any difference. And what do I really do? I mean, outside of the study teach routine, I mean, what, you know, I go work another job, a part-time job, you know, I do that. But largely my life is uneventful and boring, frankly. I mean, I'm not bored with it, but you probably would be. You know, I don't feel the need to run around and to go everywhere and to do everything. I'm pretty well content with, you know, my life, and it's simple. And I ask myself, well, how is this advancing God's plan? I mean, I'm not doing anything what I would call out of the ordinary. And you probably don't either. I mean, your day-to-day life, you probably think, well, yeah, it's just pretty basic and tedious. It is what it is. But yet, if you're thinking the right things, doing the right things, saying the right things, well, you're glorifying God in your little part of the world. And God sees all this and keeps track of it, of course. Now, if you're not, well, then that's another whole ballgame. So he causes all these things to work together for good. The good things, the bad things, the up things, the down things, the suffering, the blessing, everything is being orchestrated for my ultimate good and your ultimate good. To those who are called, to those who love God. There's the rub right there. You have to love God. Now then you have to define what is love for God. Well, we know what love for God is because Jesus defines it for us. He who has my commandments and keeps them, this is the one who loves me. So love is related to fulfilling the royal imperatives. And this is how you show your love for God, you obey him. Now it'd be nice if we could obey him perfectly, that'd be good. But we can't. And so, in one way you show your love for God is by exercising rebound when you sin, by being diligent with that. That, you know, don't just walk around out of fellowship, constantly check yourself. I mean, you can't monitor yourself every second, I get that. But, I mean, we're trying to take every thought captive, and that's a big task. But you have to, you know, like you get engrossed in a job and you're doing it and all that. Like I don't, you know, personally, if I go to the hospital, say the emergency room, I really don't want I want the nurse in fellowship, but I don't want her agonizing over that if I'm dying of a heart attack. I want her engrossed in saving my butt. I mean, that's what I want. So, you know, obviously the doctor, you know, I hope he's in fellowship, but even if he's not, I want his expertise brought to bear at that time. I'm less concerned about his spiritual status than his ability to save me at that level. So all these things happen to you. You have your good days, your good weeks, your bad weeks, your good months, your bad... You may have good years and bad years. And you think, well, I had a bad year. I wasted it. Okay, fine. You've wasted it. Now it's behind you. It's over with. It's done. What are you going to do now? That becomes the question every day. What are we going to do today? Because this is the new day that we have. So God's behind the scenes orchestrating all of this, and he doesn't love you any more on your good days than he does on your bad days. I mean, do you ever have that feeling like I'm just a wretch and there's no reason God should love me? I mean, I know who I am and I see how bad it really is. And you think, oh, well, God probably doesn't want to hear from me. You sin and you really blow it. Yeah, he wants you to still talk to him. And on those days, he's no less for you than he is on your days when you're up and sailing through everything. You know, he's for you both times. Well, one, this verse indicates that God is actively orchestrating the difficult and distressing events of life in a way that serves the ultimate good of the believer. Two, while one may argue grammatically that God does this for all believers, those who love God are emphasized in the construction. And the reason I say you could make that argument is by what follows. To those who are called according to his purpose. Well, that's all believers. But do all believers love God? And the answer to that is no, they don't. Because if you, obviously, he who does not have my commandments or does not keep them does not love God. Just the converse of what Jesus stated in the positive, we can say in the negative. Okay, if I don't have the commandments, i.e. I don't know what the royal imperatives are, and I'm not executing them. And that all starts, obviously, the royal imperatives with beginning in Bible class. Assembly is where that all begins, and then it goes from there. This is at least the starting point for the Christian life. Well, three, although God is always working all things for good, the negative believer may not recognize this truth and may not benefit from the comfort that it is designed to provide during his testing. See, God wants us to be comforted. Matthew 13. And he's for us. And again, the difficulty sometimes is believing that he's for you, knowing how bad you are. I have that same problem with some of you. That he's for you, no matter how bad you are. No, it's a personal deal. No matter how bad you are, you got to recognize, well, God's still for me. I mean, unless I just blow off his plan, give doctrine the finger, and run in the opposite direction. Well, then in that case, that's a very different deal, obviously. But none of us are doing that right now. And that's good. Matthew 13, 20 and 21. The one on whom the seed was sown in the rocky places. This is the man who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary. And when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he falls away. So, here is a situation in which the negative believer gets into the same testing and pressures that the positive believer does, but yet he reacts in a very different way. Why? Well, he's lacking a fundamental principle and a fundamental inner core of both conviction, and this is the root, from which he grows. And he's unstable. That's the problem. How many believers out there are unstable? They're constantly just like this. The Christian life isn't constantly like this. That's unstable. The Christian life does have its ups and downs. Granted, I'm not saying that it doesn't. But I mean, if you're constantly like this, there's something going on. There's something wrong. You're not orienting to some principle or something. Well, gee, suffering is a normal and regular feature of the Christian way of life. And those that advocate otherwise are not sound in the faith. 1 Peter 5:10. So, you know, and this is the prosperity preachers. God wants you healthy, wealthy, and wise. He wants you rich. God doesn't want you to suffer. If you're suffering, this is basically almost an infiltration of some of the Hindi principles into doctrine and into the Christianity, that God doesn't want you suffering. How do you know God doesn't want me suffering? How do you know God doesn't want you suffering? First, it takes a lot of presumption to say you know what God wants for people and everybody. Yeah, you know. So tell Jesus that on the cross. God doesn't want you suffering. Oh, well, bearing sins isn't easy. I'm separated from my Father for the first time in history. I've been in fellowship with the Father ever since, and now my God has forsaken me. So tell me I'm not supposed to suffer. Jesus obviously suffered. He sets the pattern for this, in fact, for us, as he endures his sufferings. 1 Peter 5:10, after you have suffered for a little while. Peter talks about it like it's a done deal. It's not up for debate. This is going to be a reality, folks. Orient to it. The God of all. But see, the suffering, one thing I like is the suffering has a limitation. It's for a little while. What if you had to suffer every day for the rest of your life? Let's say you're 50 now. And you live to 70. 20 years of suffering. Well, that's really a pretty small, when compared to eternity, that's a really small segment of time. Now, obviously I don't wish any suffering on anybody, especially myself. But yet it happens. So after you've suffered for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory will himself perfect, that's the idea of spiritually mature you. You're not going to become perfect, but you'll become a mature believer, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. And then you become a firm, stable believer, as it's pictured in Psalm 1 there, planted by the tree of water, a tree planted by a stream that yields its fruit in its season. And as a believer, you'll yield different kinds of fruit, obviously various applications, divine good production, that you make over the course of your life. So those that advocate a prosperity doctrine that teaches that the believer will not suffer in time are not only deluded, but are at odds with the Bible and the experience of believers throughout the centuries. 2 Corinthians 1:6. Again, the prosperity preachers, get my prayer cloth, put it in your wallet, and money will appear. God wants you healthy. Get the miracle healing oil. Just call this line and we'll pray for you and you'll be healed of whatever it is. Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? You know, I had a motorcycle wreck when I was 19 and pretty much crushed everything from the waist down. It would be nice if God would just fix all that for me. That I don't have the hip pain, take that away. And most of the time I don't have a lot of pain, which God obviously has blessed me there. But I'm starting to get some twinges of arthritis in various places. And I'd like to have the metal rod out of my leg and my kneecap back and the ability to bend my leg all the way would be nice. Maybe fix the nerve damage in my left leg. That'd be cool. God hasn't done it. And when I first got saved, people just said, well, you don't have enough faith. That's why God won't do it for you. And I thought, well, God, I am lousy. Not only am I suffering here, I'm a lousy believer on top of it. Well, no wonder God wouldn't want to do anything for me. Well, do you know how discouraging that is to tell somebody that? I mean, these people are just, first, and they're beating up these poor believers that don't know any better. And they're buying into this stuff. People that would not attend a church to save their life, wouldn't sit through a Bible class, but every Sunday they'll flip on Oral Roberts or Ernest Angley or whoever it is they listen to. And they're getting all this false doctrine shoveled down their throat, and then they send them their money. And at the end of it all, we have a gift for you. For your love offering of $9.95, get this message on tape. Get it on CD. Download an MP3. Wait a minute, you're not supposed to be charging for this. 2 Corinthians 1:6, but if we are afflicted, and we are, it is for your comfort and salvation. Again, when you see your spiritual leader go through the same types of suffering and testing that you go through, dealing with negative believers, dealing with negative people, dealing with suffering and keeping his life together and making sure that the priorities of doctrine are maintained, then it's an encouragement for you. Well, yeah, if Ron, he's a lousy believer, and if he can do it, I can. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. Well, he's not so much, and he manages to stay in there. So if Ron can, well, and that's kind of the same thing with Paul was saying to the Corinthians. Look, if we can do it, it's on your behalf that we do it. If we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which is effective in the patient enduring of the same suffering. Wait a minute, I don't like that. Patient enduring? Can't I bitch and moan about it? Can't I whine and complain my way to heaven? Well, you can, but it's not really, fun. But do you really have fun when you're whining and complaining and being a nit? I mean, you're not having fun when you're like that. The other day something happened. My boss did a deal and he set something up for me and I didn't like it. And I was sitting there and I kept thinking, why did you do this? And I'm going through it in my head, and I'm out of fellowship, obviously. So I'll tell on myself today. And so I'm sitting there, and I said to myself, and then I start cycling the doctor. All right, now wait a minute. You're here to do your job as under the Lord. Whatever your boss does is fine. You need to orient to this. And then 5 minutes later, I was back. Why'd he do this? You know, I'd get on top of it, and then I'd be back at it. I'm on top of it and back at it. And, you know, and you just have to fight through that stuff. And you just have to say, well, look, I've got to get oriented here. But, you know, you judge yourself and say, okay, I got to get oriented. So I need to patiently endure this. Oh, well, that makes it harder. The same sufferings which we also suffer. And he says, our hope is firmly grounded, knowing that as you are sharers of our sufferings, to the extent that you enter into any of the sufferings that go with the ministry here at Makarios, to that extent, you're going to share in the glory. And this is why, you know, like with the grace giving thing that we do, you know, we only do it on Sunday, but obviously every believer has the ability to take their finances and translate them into SG3. I mean, that's amazing. What's the greatest trick you ever saw? Well, I turned a nickel into SG3. That was a pretty good trick. How do you do it? Well, grace of God and understanding the principles and applying them. And so I can turn my money into rewards? Yeah, absolutely. So, also Philippians here, 1:29. So I did, by the way, get on top of it, and then guess what happened? The guy called and canceled, and I didn't have to do it anyway. So I went through all those gyrations, all that, and it didn't even happen. Now, how many times have you done that in your Christian life? You get all wrapped around the axle about something you think's going to happen, and then it doesn't happen. And that's when you have to say to yourself, and you need to, you know, remind yourself, where is the only place this is happening? Right here in my head. That's where it's happening. And it may not even unfold in the real world. So you anticipate the worst case scenario or whatever. How often is it that the worst case scenario never happens? It's pretty regular to my experience has been the worst case scenario seldom happens. Now I've had some of it come, my worst scenarios have come true. Well, that's tough, but it does happen. Well, Philippians 1:29, for to you it has been granted for Christ's sake. Not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. Experiencing the same conflict which you saw in me and now here to be in me. And Paul made no secret of it to those under his charge that he had the same inner conflict going on a day-by-day basis, just like I do, just like you do. And this is designed to encourage people. Hey, I'm not abnormal. Because sometimes you feel like, God, am I just weird or something? I mean, am I the only one that goes through this? No, everybody goes through it. The fighting with your STA, I'm on top of it. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. No, I'm not. You know, back and forth as you fight it out and determine. And there was an old deal, and I had heard this back when I was a fundy. This guy said, well, I feel like I've got a black dog and a white dog in me fighting it out. The guy asked him, well, which one wins? He said, the one I feed the most. There's some truth to that. The inner man that's built up in doctrine becomes a more capable opponent the more you feed him. And so, obviously, the necessity of spiritual food. Revelation 2:10 also. Now, this is a verse I can really, not get around either, because it's about suffering up until the point of death. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested. And you will have tribulation for 10 days. So are you going to tell these people oral that they aren't right with God? Or any of you other numbskulls out there proclaiming these prosperity doctrines? These poor people under your ministries, they were just out of God's will, huh? Is that it? That's where their doctrine leads to that kind of conclusion. You will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. And again, one of the things we have to do that's very important is we have to keep our sufferings in perspective. And what's the first thing that the believer does when things go wrong? In many cases, believers will panic and they blow things out of proportion. You know, like, and at some level, that's what I was doing Friday at work. There's just one little thing he asked that I didn't want to do. So I blow it all out of proportion. You always do. When you get upset and you find yourself saying crap like, you always. Most people never always do anything. You'll use these extreme terms when you're angry or when you're struggling. Always and never. You never listen to me. That's a good way to have a fight in a house. Get a husband and wife to have the wife tell you, you never listen to me. And a husband will respond, well, yeah, I do. I'm hearing you now saying that I never listened to you. Well, when you're using these extreme terms, you've probably got it out of proportion. You know, because nobody always or never does anything. So when you get to that point, you're thinking, you got to say, okay, I've got to keep this in perspective. And that's hard to do when you're in the middle of it. And you say, well, it's tough when I'm in the middle of it. Yeah, it is. That's the thing we will tell you with doctrine that they won't tell you in other places. It is tough. It is hard, and it is a battle. Two, Catholics and Hindus are among those that advocate suffering as a form of penance. That's self-imposed. You know, I did wrong, so rather than dealing with it with rebound, I'll punish myself. So you'll see this, you know, especially as we come up now towards Lent and, you know, the big bacchanal there in New Orleans before that. And then after that, then they do the, you know, Ash Wednesday, all walk around, put ashes on their heads like idiots. And think that that somehow makes God more in favor of them. I'll throw some charcoal all over you. I don't care. You know, you'll really think God's for you when I'm done. You know, anyway. So, you know, you'll see them flagellating themselves. One guy, you know, there's always a guy down there, and it's usually Mexico, where he'll crucify himself. He'll let himself be nailed to a cross. And this impresses God. Well, Constantine outlawed that as a form of death, you know, back in the 330s A.D. So why would you engage in it now? And these people, they think that this is gaining them some sort of religious merit with God. Because they beat themselves with whips and crawl on their hands and knees over glass and rocks and they're bloodied up. Oh, I'm serving Jesus. No, you're not. This isn't what Jesus is all about. Jesus never told you nail yourself to a cross. He said take up your cross and carry it. It's an instrument of execution, but the problem is you never die on it. Positionally, we have. But experientially, no, you don't nail yourself to it. That doesn't impress God. So when people commit certain sins, they think, oh, okay, I'll get it right with God by doing something good. I'll get some extra money Sunday, or I'll help somebody that I normally wouldn't help, or I'll do this. I'll pray for 5 minutes extra. I'll do 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys. And then God will be impressed with me. No. And see, and that's the weird thing. You look at the groups, Catholics and Hindus are religiously pretty close in some ways, which is weird because you wouldn't think so necessarily. Three, suffering is not an illusion as taught by the Hindus, Maya, and the New Age movement and Christian scientists. Christian scientists tells you you're not really sick. It's just an illusion. You don't really feel bad. You just think you feel bad. And if you believe you feel bad and your nose is running and you're coughing up snot and puke and all that, and you know, so you've fallen for the illusion. It's the illusion of sickness. Well, you're not sick. Yeah, you're sick. And so they have the, you know, they argue that suffering's not, it doesn't really happen. Well, guess what? It does really happen. Four, suffering is real and is not cured by meditation. I become one with God. I'll sit and chant, Ron, Ron. That's my mantra. Sometimes I reverse it, nor, nor. Well, guess what? That doesn't solve your suffering. It doesn't make it go away. If you're under emotional pressure, I'll meditate it away. Well, it's still there, still real. So wishing it away, pretending it does not exist, or being reincarnated until one achieves nirvana. Now that's a really good one, reincarnation. You just keep coming back. If you screw it up, you just keep coming back over and over again until you get it right. Well, this kind of alleviates, you know, that you really have to worry much about anything, because according to this doctrine, everybody's going to eventually get it right and go to heaven. But that's not true. That's a doctrine they teach, but it's not true. So, again, these things don't solve it. And to say it doesn't exist or to try to wish it away, I wish I wasn't suffering. Okay, how's that working for you? Not very well. Five, although the believer may enjoy the blessing of inner peace in the midst of his sufferings, the sufferings are still a real and present pressure. Just to try to say that fast. A real and present pressure, yeah. There it is. And it's not a real pleasant pressure either. John 16, 33. So they don't go away. You know, when you're under pressure and you wake up at night and you're laying there thinking about it at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're wishing you could go back to sleep, but all you're, you know, the pressure is real and you feel it, well, that's not a sin. You know, to try to deal with it is fine. But again, just pretending it's not there, that's just goofy. These things I have spoken to you so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation. But take courage. I have overcome the world. I've beat this system. And Jesus beat it essentially through doctrine and obedience to the Father at every point. That's how he beat it, was by obedience. And if we're going to beat it, that's how we're going to beat it too. So again, the need for knowing the royal imperatives. What is obedience? What's God expect out of me? The parameters for my function and my service. I need to know those. There's not an army out there that doesn't have, you know, a set of parameters in which they function. You know, it's not just chaos. They're organized, they're structured, they have authority, they have a mission, say. You know, okay, I got a mission. Well, what are the parameters of my mission? What am I supposed to do? And all that. And if you haven't seen it, I haven't seen it quite all the way through, but they said in this movie, they said at the beginning of it, more of this is true than you'd believe. You ought to see some of the things that, you know, I know it's a movie, but it's called The Men Who Stare at Goats. If you haven't seen that one, you might want to check it out. Because it shows a little bit of the kind of goofy stuff when there are no parameters, essentially, for service. So they is about MK Ultra and these other mind experiments. And they came to find out it really wasn't a good idea to give soldiers LSD to make them killing machines. And they found out, you know, certain things don't work. Well, you can have, but you got to know how to please God. Well, in the midst of the world, you can overcome all this. You're going to either overcome it or it's going to overcome you, one or the other. And the people who get overcome, they just become casualties and wash away, and that's it. Well, H, just as the sin nature is universal within the human race, suffering is also a universal fact of life. Job 5:7, and we'll get somebody who can address this out of fellowship for us, and that's Job. In Job 5, anyway, he's out of fellowship. Now, Job does get it together at the end, but of course, when God shows up and starts calling you out, you kind of realize you might have stepped in it. And Job did. He recognized it and said, oh, that's not good. Job 5, 7. Well, 6 actually. Affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. For man is born for trouble, as sparks fly upward. Also, Job 14, 1. So you're born into it at some level. You have to understand that. You didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice. This is where God in his wisdom, he created you at this point in history, has you here for a reason. So what you got to figure out is what that all that is and how to orient and acclimate to all that. Job 14:1, man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Like a flower, he comes forth and withers, and he also flees like a shadow that does not remain. And the fact is, of course, our life is but a vapor. And when you're young, again, I can remember when I was in, you know, fourth grade, fifth grade, summer seemed endless. I mean, you get out of school and, man, it was whoo. And, I mean, it was baseball all summer, climbing trees, throwing rocks, fishing, camping, hunting. I mean, and then they didn't tell me when you grow up you're not going to get that three-month vacation every year. Boy, that would be nice, wouldn't it? I think I'm going to, that's what we ought to campaign for. 3 months off every summer for everybody. Well, I guess that wouldn't work too well. You couldn't go to McDonald's. So, man, life is short. Now, again, when you're young, it doesn't seem like it's a short. But the older you get, the more you realize, oh, yeah, it's short. And that's why Solomon's very clear there. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, because the days are going to come and come quicker than you think when it's not going to be as easy as it is now. It's far easier to get out and apply and make do the things you have to do when you're 20, 25, 30, 35. Again, when you get older, it's more difficult. These things don't come as easy. So if you haven't trained yourself to do them, that's a problem as well. Ecclesiastes 2:23, mentioning Solomon here. Ecclesiastes 2:23, verse 22, this is good. For what does a man get in all his labor and his striving which he labors under the sun? At the end of it all, what have you done? I like that movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. At the end of it all they'll say was, he was here and he had some shower curtain rings. That's all they're going to know me for, the shower curtain ring guy. Well, he made his mark, I guess. So what do you get from all your striving, all the things, all you've done, all your life, all you've accomplished, all the deal? You know, I saw yesterday they were presenting the Gold Glove Award. Evan Longoria got it from last year. And that'll go on his shelf. I mean, 30 years from now, he'll look at it and say, boy, I was good then. But it's tough now. I can't play baseball anymore. And so what do you get from all of this? All the awards, all the accolades. What does it really achieve you at the end of your life? Because I guarantee you, when Evan or any of them die or come up face to face with death, they're not going to say, where's my trophy? They're not going to be concerned about that, their achievements. That won't matter. They'd trade all that for 5 more minutes of life, wouldn't they? Yeah, when people come up face to face with death, they'll trade anything for life. They don't want to die. So because all his days, his task is painful and grievous, even at night his mind does not rest. This too is emptiness, vanity. Doesn't amount to anything. So therefore, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This I have seen that it is from the hand of God. See, God does provide comfort in the midst of this relatively futile life that we live. And he calls it a futile life, say Peter, the futile way of life inherited from our forefathers. So you look back through your family tree. What great things did your family do? How did they change the world? And even if they did, when most of our families did not, but even if they did make some great contribution, does anybody remember them? That's another thing Solomon says. The human race has a very short memory. So even if you do manage to do something, will anybody remember? No. 2 years from now, if I ask you who won the Gold Glove 2 years ago, you won't remember that it was Evan Longoria, probably. You might if you follow sports, but mostly probably not. Also, Romans 8, 18 through 23 in the New Testament. So, some of this, some of our suffering comes from the very fact that the human race is under the STA deal. And it brings its own form of evil and suffering with it. I mean, you've probably had that experience. If you're a growing believer, I'll bet you've, and you've been around a while, you've had the experience of why am I doing what I'm doing? I do not understand what I do. But the very things I hate, I practice. And the very things I want to do, I don't seem to get those done. Because, and you've probably had that dichotomy that exists within the adjusting believer of, God, what is wrong with me? There's something very, very wrong with me. And guess what? We all have it. It's the nature of it. Romans 8, 18 through 23. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are what? Constantly to be compared. No, never to be compared. They're not even worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. And here's the problem for the positive believer. It's keeping his eyes on the eternal. It's getting your eyes off the temporal world and what's going on around you right now and focusing on that which really matters. Set your mind on the things above, where Christ is at the right hand of God. Don't be caught up in this temporal world. And even when you do suffer in this temporal world, it's not worthy to be compared to the true glory. But see, we haven't seen any of the glory yet. So you have to live on this one by faith. But the righteous live by faith. That's the nature of the beast. So if you're walking by faith, what is your level of eternal glory going to be? Well, you don't know. But looking at any of us now, you would think, well, who knows? We're just, you know, regular, normal people. Nothing out of the ordinary as far as I can see. Romans 8, 18, it's not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed. For the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For creation was subjected to futility, not willingly. See, God cursed the ground. Cursed is the ground because of you, Adam. And God didn't curse Adam and Eve. That's an important point. He cursed the serpent, he cursed the ground, but he didn't curse Adam and Eve. That language of cursing is never used with respect to them. But here the creation, the world is suffering even as it is. because of this. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will also be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And so when we actually appear in our glory, in the resurrection body, during the millennium and beyond, the world will be a better place, believe it or not. It'll be, in some ways, the world benefits from all of this. Even the physical creation. There'll be changes in the physical creation because of the glory that's to be revealed. As we know, the lion will lie down with the lamb. The lion will eat a straw like the ox. The child will play by the hole of the viper and won't get killed. You know, you get bit by a brown recluse now, a rattlesnake, pygmy rattler out there somewhere, you're going to suffer, maybe die. That'll never happen in the millennium. And we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth until now. I mean, this world is literally in labor, trying to be delivered. And the birth is actually going to be through the revelation of the sons of God. And not only this, but we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves. Sanctified complaining, in a sense. Well, although we're not complaining, we're groaning. There is a difference. Why? Because we want to be delivered. We are waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons. And that's not phase one adoption. Obviously, we're already sons. What he's talking about is the transformation of the physical body. When we get our glory. The redemption of our body. He defines it for you there, so you don't have to guess. For in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it. And so if you can keep your eyes on the eternal, and not get dragged down, or not get bogged down, and not become weary in well-doing, and all these other things, you'll go a long way towards living the Christian life right there. That'll get you a long ways into it. Okay, well, our time is gone. We're going to have to stop there, so we will resume with point I on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.